Ooh, I'm the ghost. Wait a minute, it's after Halloween already, isn't it?
Well,
sorry. Did you know that I hadn't died? The last week we haven't talked.
I thought that maybe that was your costume. You're going as Dead Shane.
Yeah, no. I thought maybe I'd be able to hold it. You might think that I was a ghost for a little while because I missed the show last week. Those of you that listened,
did you miss it, Bob?
Thank you, Kevin. Yes, sure. I'm looking at you when I say I missed the show last week, and he's nodding his head like, "Yeah, you idiot. I know that."
No. It was one of these deals where, obviously, conspicuous by your absence, and then we tried to, and you'll have to go back and listen to it, but we tried to surmise what you would say on a couple of occasions. So that part's fun.
Well, the reason it was conspicuous is because last week was my album pick. We had the three album cycle, where normally on the show we pick an album that none of us know that well, but we specifically chose for 3 weeks to pick an album that at least one of us knew really, really well. And my pick last week was My Bloody Valentine's Loveless. And then I wasn't here to do my own fucking record.
It was Shaneless. We were Shaneless for Loveless, as it were.
That sort of sounds like if Garth Brooks did a, like, baby, I'm Shaneless, and like did his own version of Loveless, which would be amazing.
Well, right, and it would buy him a boat, but that's not what's happening here tonight.
I don't know that it would buy him anything. It would buy me a boner to hear Garth Brooks do My Bloody Valentine. Anyway, we'll get off. So how did it go last week? Because I specifically have not listened to the show yet, and I haven't talked to you about it because...
You wanted to come in with fresh ears. Which
yeah,
makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah, no, it was great. We had a good time. Of course, Ryan and I are grizzled veterans at this stage, but we were joined by our friend Phil last week, who... was really interesting. I will tell you in all seriousness, one of the interesting things about having Phil sit in on a show that you missed is that you're both like pop rock songwriters. Like you like songs that have great lyrical content and that are sort of, for lack of a better term, like almost like interesting perfect circles. Like they don't drag on.
Concise.
Sort of more traditional than a, you know, teeming miasma that goes on for as long as that record goes on.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, but that song, I mean, and I'll put in my two cents really quick and we'll get to the, but you know what? I don't need to put my two cents in about that. I do want to address this one thing. And those of you that listen to the show might be noticing that right now where you would normally hear Kevin's brother Ryan chiming in, he's not chiming in.
No.
I'm looking at an empty chair.
No, he's not here.
We don't know where he is.
Yes, Ryan is off the reservation as it stands now. Usually I would think that means that he's just decided that now is the time he's going to do his laundry.
Or take a nap.
But no, that's not what's happening. He's not here.
We've been assured. Yeah. Stay posted.
Yeah, the rumor is that he'll be joining us in a little while. We'll see if that happens, but for now... It's Shane and I, and then we teased this a little bit last week when my friend Mark Cuvion stopped by and told us what we would be enduring this week, and so I would like before we get into whatever we're gonna listen to and talk about this tonight, I wanted to welcome Mark Cuvion.
Hi, thank you. I'm really really happy to be here. I'm happy to actually have a microphone this week.
Yeah, I know.
I kind of had to sit here through the whole thing.
He's like, I'm so close.
Keep my mouth shut. I had so many things to say about My Bloody Valentine and just had to kind of.
Well, you could say those this week if you wanted to.
Yeah, I'm sure at some point I'm going to want to say something about it in the middle of what we're going to be talking about.
Because they're really similar in terms of.
They really are, actually, yes.
Yeah, sprawling.
Which, without getting into all that stuff directly.
Oh, God, you're going to make me vomit. I do want to say this before you get started, Kevin. Mark, I'm very happy for you that you're joining us in the garage in the beginning of November when it's 72 degrees outside rather than in the middle of July when it was 103 degrees outside.
We're all
clearly, I orchestrated that, feigning my interest.
We were
my disinterest, I should say.
Yeah.
and being a part of the podcast until now.
We were all like an ant under a magnifying glass for like 3 months.
Kevin
like
would get so sweaty, and he would like he wouldn't be able to sit down. Do you remember that? Would never sit down. You would always stand up because there would be more air.
Yeah, you just got to keep moving. And then, you know, other than that, you'd hate to sit down and like the pleather backing of this chair. You hear some weird sucking sound.
Stuck to it.
As I try to get up. But I do want to circle back to one thing before we get to the theme music and the rest of the show. And that was, I meant to tell you this, and when we were talking a little bit about Halloween before we actually got started here, apparently there's a deal now where like one of the TV stations in town has like a heat map, like kind of like, you know, what you do
like
with weather
patterns. Like what the Predator saw?
Oh, no. Well, no, not exact, not that kind of heat map, really.
Not
but,
those kind of predators either.
But yeah, it would be like a storm map that the weather team would show or whatever. But it was all the neighborhoods that give out the most candy.
Yeah,
and our neighborhood was like, it was like if it would have been a weather map, it would have been like, get to the basement. Like it was that bad. Like it was all solid red. And then we took my 4 year old and we walked up and down the street for a couple of blocks, and literally it was entire families like just sitting out on their porch and giving up way too much candy to my kid.
Well,
like,
yeah, there actually are mobile apps for that as well. That
all right,
that you can track and they're crowdsourced. So
yeah,
as people are going around, they're basically putting in the information about the candy that they're getting at houses, and
that is
and
so nerdy.
Collects all this data.
That's what you say. I choose to think that is a direct real world application of the NSA spying on all of us.
Oh my God!
And with that, let's go to the theme music. I am Shane.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Somebody Likes It. Welcome back to Somebody Likes It, and let me just share a little nugget from a review that I found about the record that we're going to cover tonight before we get into what this record is. And bear in mind, like, I know that if you're seeing the posted podcast, you know what the record is that we're covering, but for the sake of drama, we won't mention it just yet. This is a piece that showed up in Consequence of Sound on a reissue of this record, and this is what they said. Fifth highest selling album of all time. Over 43 million copies sold worldwide. 12 times platinum in the U.S. alone. An average of 200,000 copies sold each year to this day. Topped the U.K. charts for 474 weeks. The musicians and performers on the record include Roy Bataan, Max Weinberg, Todd Rundgren, who also produced the record, Phil Rizzuto, the famed New York Yankees baseball announcer, and members of the New York and Philadelphia Symphony. Can you guess the album? Dark Side of the Moon? Nope. Back in Black? Nope. Blonde on Blonde? Still nope. Born to Run? Close. Eagles' Greatest Hits? Not a Chance. Answer? Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf.
Unbelievable.
Isn't that
I do like
staggering?
I do like that Born to Run was close.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And Mark, you selected this method of torture, so
yeah, I did.
Tell
yeah.
us, you know.
Well, I think that review right there actually kind of sums up why I selected this, because I knew the commercial success of this album, and it was one that I've never really understood. I've never understood why it was so successful, and so
you're
it
not
kinda,
the only one.
It kind of really fit in to me the theme, you know. Obviously, somebody likes it. There are a lot of people like it, or maybe they don't, and that's hopefully what we'll get into tonight.
So they're buying it out of spite.
I was just raising my hand to say I don't.
Yeah,
right. No,
I somehow slipped through the cracks. I had never heard even one of these songs before.
Yeah.
Somehow, except recently, I had, and we'll talk about this in a little while later. I had heard. What was the damn song with the play-by-play? Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is one of the softball cheesiest song titles. And I mean, roll your eyes. This is something that I read when I was researching, and I say that word loosely. This album is Todd Rundgren, who produced the album, and I know, Mark, you want to talk a little bit about this later, but Todd Rundgren was quoted saying that that Steinman. Where is the quote?
And we should mention who Steinman is.
Oh, Jim Steinman. Yeah. So basically, this album, though it's sung by Meatloaf, the songs were all written by Jim Steinman, who later went on and had crazy big hits also with Celine Dion and
Air Supply, Bonnie Tyler.
Yeah. Right. Which I love Totally Eclipse of the Heart so much that it almost makes up all. You know what? No, it doesn't.
Can't you hear it like his version of
it? Oh, completely. Like, yeah. Once I knew he wrote Totally Eclipse of the Heart, and I, by the way, had never heard a Meatloaf song before ever until today, except I Would Do Anything for Love off of Bat Out of Hell 2. But so anyway, so Todd Rundgren, we were just talking about Paradise by the Dashboard Light, and Rundgren was saying Jim would always come up with, I'm sorry, this is his manager, David Sonnenberg, would say Jim would always come up with these great titles, and then he would try to write a song that would justify the greatness of the title. Sorry, Paradise by the Dashboard Light is not a great title. It's sophomoric and cliche. A Bat Out of Hell is not a great, it's a fucking, these are, you took the words right out of my mouth, all revved up with no place to go. Two out of three ain't bad.
The thing that really blows me away about these songs, too, is that they're adapted from songs that he wrote for an adaptation of Neverland.
Yeah, fucking Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. And they're about, like, hanging out in the backseat of a car with a girl.
It's pretty fucking Peter Pan if you think about it in certain ways. Well, you know, like, obviously, this guy's view towards sexuality and women is pretty Peter Pan, but, I mean, that's a whole other discussion.
I think there are a few things that I just find really amusing about this record, not the least of which is, like, the juxtaposition of some of this, like, okay, weird Peter Pan musical, the musicology of the record itself, you know, juxtaposed with the Dio-like cover that's there.
Yes.
It's like, you look at that cover and you think, well, is this record is going to be proggy?
This album is going to rock my ass off. That's what you think. Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah. You'd be like, I'm going to have to get a new ass after this is over.
Yeah, it's like,
no.
Because there is something that Rundgren said, and it's not a direct quote here in this article, but speaking of Paradise again, how he Rundgren jokes that he can't imagine Steinman being at a lakeside with the most beautiful girl in school, but he can't imagine Steinman imagining it. So I think that's
brilliant.
Yeah,
like it is. It's a degree. It's a level removed from reality, and that sounds about accurate.
Well, but right. But also there's something to be said that he says about the most beautiful girl in school. I mean, it's almost prepubescent in certain. It's definitely not a guy with a healthy, functioning adult sense of relation. It's
libido,
a guy pining it's like the Wonder. It's like Kevin from the Wonder Years pining about Winnie and then writing sexually explicit songs about it in his 40s.
Yeah, and it's all it's sexual conquest too, isn't it? It's not really. There is no maturity there because I mean it's you know basically he wants to just. Bang this girl, and she's like, you know, well, are you going to still love me forever? And he's, well, let me sleep on it. You know, I mean, there's no relationship building thing.
There's not a lot of maturity. Jim Steinman right now, thank God for him having sold the amount of records he sold. Thank God for him that he was in his mid-20s in the late 70s rather than in now, because he would have channeled all of his thoughts and feelings toward his unrequited loves into trolling on the internet instead of writing these, like, Grease knockoff songs.
That's a good idea. I mean, good point.
Because
this is
one step away from, tell me more, tell me more, tell me more, tell me more.
That probably explains
most of his success was writing more of those Broadway type of musical hits.
Part of that was Meatloaf, though, too. I mean, he was in Hair, I'm pretty sure.
He was in Hair.
Yeah. He has You know, he has absolutely no range as a vocalist. It's all bombast all the time. Like, crank it up. These guys were a match made in heaven. I have a lot to say about this record, but I think I've alluded to this so far, but I just want to just make sure you guys really know how I feel about this record. I hate this album more than anything I've ever listened. It combines everything. It's sort of like if the devil
warms my heart.
Would come and I knew it would. And I've been waiting. When I was talking to a friend of mine today, and he knows I do the show on ladies and gentlemen. Breaking news. Ryan has emerged from the cave.
We have a Ryan.
Ryan has emerged. Ryan, how do you feel?
We're on the scene with Ryan.
Well rested.
He has, in fact, taken the nap that we posited he might have taken.
the 27-hour, this is the thing. Is like Ryan is unaffected by the time change in a way that no one else is. Like you gained an hour every day,
savings.
And it makes no difference whatsoever.
He's walked in, calmly placed his sustenance in a circle: Jack Link's beef jerky, New Amsterdam vodka, and a bottle of Squirt.
It's nice to see you went with the.
We're ready to party, boys.
You went with the name brand jerky this week. You were on
yeah,
the.
Yeah, I didn't have time to get by HEB, so right. I had to go to my local corner store.
Well, nice. Hey, listen, why don't we go ahead, because I was just about to ramp shit up even more. Why don't we go ahead and play a clip? We'll check in with Ryan, and right. then and we'll return. So
maybe a little bit of the title track?
Yeah, let's move into the title track a little bit.
Turn
and we'll
out
place
of
all
hell.
That.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I see you're on the same page with us.
Let the pilot
he doesn't need
again.
To be ramped up at all.
All right, this is going to be bad out of hell. Here we go.
Oh, baby, you're the only thing in this whole world that's good and good and right. And wherever you are and wherever you go, there's always going to be some light. But I gotta get out, I gotta break it out now before the final cocktail is gone. So we gotta make the most of our one night together. When it's over, you know we'll both be so alone.
I will say that when I first started listening to this, that first 15 seconds or so, I was like, wait a second, this may not be too bad. I had never really listened to this album from the beginning, and I started to kind of hear some tings of maybe some prog rock going on in there. But then I soon realized, much like the other six songs on this album, this first song is basically just a really bad run-on sentence that... It just switches directions back and forth.
Never ends. It just beats you into submission.
No, none of them never end. They're all like 8 minutes long, 12 minutes long.
Yeah, I was getting ready to listen to this record. I'm like, oh, it's only seven songs long. Like, all right. Like, and then
46 and a half minutes of pure
hell. And yeah. It's nightmare.
It is
and
a bad
that's
out
why,
of hell.
That's got to be why it is at every single... photo you see of Meatloaf, he's in that sweaty tux. Like, you just feel like he got on stage and at some point he thought it might go well, and then he's like halfway through, he's like, these songs aren't anywhere close to being done. So, yeah.
Well, apparently a lot of fucking people thought they were done because over 40, I can't even say it. I can't.
Here's another little piece from this AV Club article that I think is pretty great. This guy says, here's what's awesome about Bad Out of Hell. It comes from the age of the mega album where nearly every year saw the release of a Frampton Comes Alive level blockbuster that the buying public simply had to own. Bad Out of Hell is so stubbornly offbeat that it had no business selling 43 million copies worldwide.
See, here's the thing. Like, I feel like, and I think that some of the quotes from Rundgren would maybe back this up. This was one giant joke. This thing was really just somebody was trying to pull a fast one over on the music industry.
I think that Rundgren thought that. See, I there's no way that you pay attention to Meatloaf at all and have any, even just a pass. By the way, you guys know he lives in Austin, don't you?
I know that he bought a place in Austin a couple of years ago. I didn't know.
We should have invited him over.
He's been living here at least part-time, at least half the year for the last few years. I hope I run into him any day now. I can ask him to sing me a song on the street. I'm sure both he and I would love that.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think Rundgren definitely knew that there were, or thought it was a joke, thought it was hilarious.
I mean, he said as much. He said, if this isn't a joke, it should be, because it's just... And then you have people like Max Weinberg that jump in on this project. All these really great musicians come in, and I feel like it just became kind of this wave of buy-in, almost like a hipster movement or something. Where
I don't know if what you guys have discussed just yet, as I was a little bit late, but they're show tunes. It's High School Musical.
That's what I was saying right before you got here. It combines. This is how much I hate this album. It's everything. By the way, I genuinely now believe that the genre of punk rock was directly created in 1977 and the few years before to combat the forces of evil.
This kind of steaming pile of festering shit.
It's so, so bad. It sounds like, to me, it sort of outtakes from Godspell. Like from a high school version of God's. And I also, like, the worst parts about Grease, and don't get me wrong, in my opinion,
all of Grease is
everything
bad.
About Grease is wrong.
The worst part? All of it.
All of it. There's not one. It's so nailable. I can't even talk. It's like nails on a chalkboard. It's like if the entire world's nails went down a chalkboard at the same time. That's how I feel when I listen to the "Tell Me More, Tell Me More, Tell Me More."
You and I are on the same page, brother.
Okay, so combine that with like bullshit backdoor prog rock, but mostly bullshit high school rejected musicals by Corky St. Clair.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah,
Waiting
for Guffman.
Waiting for Guffman.
Oh, yeah. It's Christopher Guest and Waiting for Guffman, directed by Corky St. Clair. And then you've got classic, like the worst of classic rock. Sorry to Mark, you mentioned Kansas, but Kansas falls dead in the middle of shit that fucking sucks from that decade. And combine it all
Kansas
in this one.
Kansas sucks, but it's genius level shit compared to this.
You like, got to understand, I grew up on that.
No, that's a good song, but that's an outlier. But yes, you're right. I mean, it is. I mean, compared to this is unlistenable, and it says so much. I want to say it says so much about the taste of the American buying public that it sells still to this day, sells 200,000 copies a month?
A year.
Okay.
And the deal is like apparently it not only topped the UK charts for that long, whatever it was, 200 and some odd weeks, but it's never left. It's still on the UK charts, apparently. Apparently.
Well, I mean, to its credit or not credit, you don't got to sell a whole hell of a lot to be on the UK charts. But let me ask you this question.
Which is more than maybe this deserves.
More than
right,
warranted.
Shane, are you on the UK charts?
No. No, and it's that's not sour grapes, Mark. That's not sour grapes that Meatloaf has been on the UK charts for 33 years.
So I don't know if you guys did any research into like the process of how this record came to be.
They
recorded it first, and then shopped it around a lot. And it got rejected a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
One important point about that they went to Rundgren and basically told him that they already had a deal.
They lied about it,
got him to get on board. He fronted most of the money, and then
paid for the record himself.
He paid for it, and then
once
it wasn't until he was able.
Got rejected again.
Right.
A lot.
Right.
So, I don't know, Mark, I think you mentioned that you have seen the quote from Clive Davis, legendary record executive Clive Davis. And you know what? Like, if I were Clive Davis and I rejected this record and it still went on to sell 43 million copies, I think I'd still be proud of myself for rejecting this record. Because, Shane, go ahead and read what Mr. Davis had to say about it.
I had it pulled up, too, yeah. Do you know how to write a song? Do you know anything about writing? If you're going to write for records, it goes like this. A, B, C, B, C, C. I don't know what you're doing. You're doing A, D, F, G, B, D, C. You don't know how to write a song. Have you ever listened to pop music? Have you ever heard any rock and roll music? You should go downstairs when you leave here and buy some rock and roll records. And apparently, as they're walking down the street, the singer, as clever as ever, Meatloaf screams out, "Fuck you, Clive! Whoa, what it is!"
Clever.
But you know what? He did get the last word on that. I will say, you know why he got the last word? For the same reason that Walker, the Texas Ranger, was on the air for 8 fucking seasons. That never underestimate the lack of taste.
Well, what's the P.T. Barnum quote? Nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public.
Yeah, that's completely. There's the summation of that.
Yeah,
and that really, I mean, it really is. I mean, you look at the popularity of piano bars. I mean, we have a couple here in Austin, and people go in
and they
will pack the place. They will spend thousands and thousands of dollars a night on liquor, listening to some guy play really campy show tunes. And they'll sing along.
It's true. It's true. What is that, though? I mean, I don't get it. I don't get the Billy Joel stuff. I don't.
Well, and we talked a little bit about this when my friend Jeff was in town, because he used to manage a piano bar for a number of years. And one of the things that he did, it's worth bringing up again, was like after those songs drove him crazy for a little while, he went out and bought all the originals. He bought Billy Joel, he bought Elton John, and he was like, okay, I need to like reconnect with why it is people give a shit about this music in the first place. And that worked for like a few weeks.
Right, and then it went away.
And then he went out and bought like Bat Out of Hell and couldn't figure it out.
So anyway, but I do think that, like, you know, the part of the backstory of this record Ryan touched on, and another part is like it was born a little bit, not a little bit, out of the New York theater scene, and you can certainly hear that in the way that it comes
together.
That's all it sounds like.
It just sounds like, you know, what do they call them? Original cast recording of whatever the fuck show this is.
All in my notes, I wrote so many notes about how it just sounds like regional theater high school musicals.
I did find it kind of interesting that that one of the backup singers was the had the original Marky Post role in
right. Ellen Foley.
Night Court.
Was on Night Court. Yeah, she was in the first season.
She was the first.
You know what?
Whatever her name was.
Very interesting.
Marky Post role.
Yes. Interesting. She was the woman that sang on Paradise.
Yeah. She does the duet on Paradise.
She also describes this album as prepubescent sexual mentality, which nail on the head.
What?
hit the nail. Yes, if your idea of tongue-in-cheek winking humor is Paradise by the Dashboard Light,
but there's
so much subtlety in that.
But that's not really even the least subtle part of the song. The least subtle part of the song is it's the literal baseball interpretation of getting to second base, getting to third base. Like
I can feel you blush. I can see you blushing and feel myself blushing at how embarrassed we are. Both of us are embarrassed about this shitty fucking record.
There's a Reese Witherspoon role where I'm not gonna be able to remember what the name of the film was, but basically the premise of the movie is there's the guy that stars in the movie looks exactly like Britt Daniel, which is also funny, but the deal is that he's special needs. And she's a sorority girl, and she ends up falling for him. And so it's this, and Francis Ford Coppola directed it. It's like great, and it's really Pumpkin. That's what it's called.
Oh, that's not Reese Witherspoon. That's
Christina Ricci. Yeah. That's who it is. Anyway,
yeah, she falls in love.
But the best part of the movie, and this
mentally
is
mentally challenged individual.
Yes. The best part of the film, and this is what made me think about it, is like she goes to see like a school counselor. And she's like, well, what would you say? The guy's like, you can tell me anything that you want to say. Like, this is a, you know, this is a safe place for you. And she goes, well, what would you say if I told you that I'd fallen for the boy? You know, I think I'm falling in love with the boy, the special needs boy that I'm helping as part of this charity. And he goes, okay. And she said, he's retarded. And the guy goes, well, when you say retarded, what do you mean? And she goes, retarded. Like, that's what I feel about this record. Like,
it's
like,
retarded.
And there's no, like...
And it's not so bad that it's good.
No, well...
It's so bad that it's just fucking bad. Like,
bad.
Like, okay, so...
go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, in the middle of Paradise by the Dashboard Light there's this little interlude that comes in, and Phil Rizzuto starts doing this play-by-play, as you mentioned, kind of this literal interpretation of
he did radio calling for the Yankees for years and years.
And
he was an actual play-by-play guy.
Yeah,
so
and an actual baseball player before that. Still bad.
Oh, no, I wasn't defending it. No, you're looking at me because you know I like baseball. No, I was just pointing out for those of us that are...
My point was that for years and years, and I don't know if this was up until he passed away in 2007. He was 100 years old almost, but he denied knowing that this song was about sex. Like, he was adamant about it. And
that's
like,
great.
And you know, he was fairly active in the Catholic Church in his community.
There's no fucking way he didn't know that.
He had to have known. I mean, unless he was completely isolated from the whole thing. But the point is that the guy, I think he was genuinely embarrassed to have even been a part of it once he realized what it really was.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for this record. And Kerrang! Magazine, I guess that's...
Oh, yeah.
It was like a British heavy metal magazine.
Right. They named this album number 38 among the 100 greatest heavy metal albums of all time.
Where's the metal?
Yeah, what fucking... Show me one metal note on this entire goddamn record. Yeah, I mean, the cover looks kind of metalish, but like...
We talked about
that when you weren't here. I think... and this is... The other day I was listening to a Def Leppard song was just on the radio, and I was like, I remember when this band was considered heavy metal. I think what we used to think was heavy metal diverged from what we actually consider heavy metal today when Metallica and its ilk came along. Because before, I think it had nothing to do with the music. It was more of the bluster and the posturing and the costuming. That's a whole other discussion.
It was theatrical.
No, but that's my... I mean, if you think about like the hardness of bands like Slayer and Metallica, I mean, there's definitely a divergence from... I mean, in the 80s, bands like... Would you ever consider Def Leppard to be a metal band?
I mean, they're metal-ish. It's pop metal.
It's pop music. I mean, the guy's got a growly voice, but that's it. I mean, this guy, it's the artifice. It's that matters more than the music, predating when you see that divergence in the lineage.
Let me share one more little nugget. Same AV Club review mentions Robert Christgau, who we talked about a little bit the week before last, and says in his C-minus review of the finished album, Robert Christgau writes, "Occasionally it seems that horrified, contemptuous laughter is exactly the reaction this production team intends, and it's even possible that 2% of the audience will get the joke. But the basic effect is grotesquely grandiose. Bruce Springsteen, beware. This is what you've wrought, and it could happen to you." And, like, you know, I mean, the thing is like, well, we won't go down the rabbit hole on this. Like, I don't totally get Springsteen. Like, I just don't. The way that, like, there's some sort of like secret passage that everybody on the East Coast gets that I don't get, but it does seem like there is some sort of over the topness to this record that is not dissimilar to some things that have been done by other artists.
Well, Kevin,
not necessarily
did I ever tell you about when I saw Bruce Springsteen in concert?
No, what happened?
It was totally on accident.
And it was 4 hours.
You stumbled on a place?
Well, sort of. My ex-girlfriend won tickets off the radio, and, you know, neither one of us were, like, big Bruce Springsteen fans, but we're like, screw it, we'll check it out, whatever. That was a whole giant production. Like, they might as well just call the thing Bruce! it was highly choreographed. He had like a dozen people on stage. You know, there was a lot of running around. I mean, it was a whole thing. It was a weird subculture that I didn't know existed, and it was a lot more theatrical than what we typically think of as Bruce Springsteen being this, you know, kind of heartland, you know, man of the people, gritty rock music or whatever.
Well, yeah, this is when he had like production. Clarence Clemons, like the enormous
was still in the band, yeah,
sax player, like
on this Mortal Coil.
And you expected him to come out with an acoustic guitar, a handkerchief in his back pocket.
Yeah, well, his persona, at least as far as I knew, was kind of, you know, he was this, hey man, I'm Bruce Springsteen. It's just me and a guitar, and you know, I got my backing band, and we're like a bar band, but we're big and famous now. But like, no, it was a giant production.
I don't really, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that it makes more sense to me now. When I was reading the comparisons about this record to like Bruce Springsteen, I was like, I don't really get a lot of that. I mean, Bruce Springsteen wrote songs. Now, granted, I'm not that into his songs, most of them, but they don't meander in, you know, a bunch of different directions and go on for days and make me want to, like, you know, put meat cleavers in my ear.
The only thing that sounds similar to me is the sound of the piano, and no coincidence because it was Springsteen's piano player playing on this. Otherwise, I don't see how you could draw any remote comparison, and I can't stand Springsteen stuff either, but I can respect it. This shit is just a fucking cesspool of nonsense. I don't respect it in any fucking way at all.
It is, I have to say, it is fun, to break the fourth wall for a second, it is fun to beat an album like a pinata, and this one deserves it.
Yeah, if nothing else, having suggested this album, I am thrilled to see that Shane is not holding back at all.
Pshaw. Yeah. Mark goes, hey, if I suggest this record, do you think it'll rub everybody the wrong way? And I was like, I kind of hope so. So we're actually a little bit over on time.
Yeah, let's listen to a song. We were talking about Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Well, there's no way to even explain. It's like 18 minutes. It's like a three-part. There's three movements in the song.
Yeah.
So
it'll really piss Clive Davis off.
Four movements, if you count the one that I had.
All right. Well,
yeah, I was about to make that same joke, Mark. Thanks.
Oh, God. Yeah. Take that shit on the road. No pun intended.
All right.
All right.
Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Here we go.
Oh, it's cold and lonely in the deep of night. I can see
So we talked a lot about the sort of theatrical thing that's going on here and how pervasive it is and why, and those reasons should be pretty obvious. But one of the reasons that I think this record ended up taking off the way they did in terms of sales.
Please tell me.
Was because Homeboy managed to talk the folks that did Rocky Horror Picture Show into using this as a trailer that would run before movie.
Oh my God, that's,
well, like specifically, I think one of the
Paradise,
the video,
Paradise,
the video for Paradise,
yeah,
was a trailer for Rocky Horror the movie.
Yeah. So anyway,
and musically it fits squarely in that camp, and I do mean camp. In
I was
going to
say, like, good job, Ryan.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, for whatever that's worth, I mean, I do feel like because that movie went on to have this sort of weird cult status, staying power. Like, I don't necessarily know that trailer goes with it everywhere all the time forever, but it probably didn't hurt.
Well, I do feel like that movie, at least, people were watching that with a wink and a nudge. You know, like, kind of, they were watching it in over the top way, and I don't know if, I mean, I feel like some people genuinely like this record.
Yeah.
And there's something wrong with
how?
It. But see, that's what I don't understand. That's why I think this is a big joke, because there is that tongue in cheek that goes along with Rocky Horror.
Is this a joke?
And I just feel like this was a joke until some people started to think that this was, you had to be cool and you had to like this album in order to be cool. I don't know.
I can't tell if it's a joke at all, but I will say this, like, joke records don't sell 43 million fucking albums.
Somebody was buying this earnestly.
Yeah, a lot of people were buying it earnestly. I think in the beginning, I think you've got kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think a lot of people thought it was jokey, but you also, here's another thing, like one of the cardinal rules about a novelty song: get in and get out. It's very brief. These songs are like 9 minutes fucking long. If they're supposed to be joke songs, like these guys, can you imagine a fucking comedian that goes up to the mic, starts to tell you a joke, meanders for about 9 minutes, doesn't tell you a punchline, and then goes to the next joke.
Yeah.
And that goes for 9 minutes. That's essentially what this album is, if it's a joke album.
I want to know if anyone else at any point...
Are there this many masochists in the world?
Basically visualize Jack Black doing a cover of this entire album.
I'd rather fucking kill myself.
But that sounds about right.
That's about how I saw it, was that... Like, I just saw that this maybe fueled Jack Black's entire character.
I think there's pieces of that, definitely.
I do not like Tenacious D. I just enjoy
you and I are exactly yeah. where
Tenacious
I like
D was
I
funny
like
for 5 minutes.
My music
I was going to say, yeah, again, and it's the same thing. It's brevity. Like, I mean, I think this. I'm with you on that, Mark. Like, yeah, it's really funny to me in small doses, but the joke wears thin really quickly. And that's the same thing I want to point. I would point out if one were to see this album as a novelty album, then a third of the way through the first fucking song, it's no longer fun. Like, the joke's over.
Can I just say that speaking of actors that sort of work a lot like or have personas that are not unlike Jack Black,
Jack Webb.
Allison, my wife, does a really great impersonation of a director giving John Lithgow stage directions, and it goes like this. Can you bring it up a notch? I need more obnoxia. But there are people who like sort of live in that camp, to circle back to what Ryan said, and this is nothing if not campy.
That's true.
I just can't figure out if it's intentionally campy or not.
No, there's no way it's intentionally campy. That's the thing that I'm saying. Yeah. If it were intentionally campy, it wouldn't be as long as it is. Self-indulgence comes with, like, the longer the song, the more likely you are to be incredibly self-indulgent. And the more self-indulgent you are, the more seriously you take yourself. And the more seriously you take yourself.
I genuinely thought this shit was deep.
Dude, they fucking shopped this shit for 2 years. You don't do that. If you're a comedian or if you're doing something like, you fucking retool what you're doing. They thought these songs were so goddamn good. They dealt with rejection for 2 years.
What pisses me off is that they
everything
ended up being,
about it.
Well, what pissed me off, they ended up being redeemed. You know, you'd like to think there's some justice in the world.
Well, there's more to say, but we're running a little bit long, and I do think we ought to get to the
to our intermission
segment,
single.
Which is also called
a few minutes with.
God, why am I forgetting that? All right, and we won't tell you what it's going to be, but again, it'll be a little bit of a departure. Coming up, a few minutes with.
So that was Get Out of My Life, Billy Ocean. No, I'm sorry. Shane, what was that?
Get Out of My Dreams, comma, Get Into My Car.
Get Into My Car. We have just watched the evidently innovative for its time video for said atrocity.
It was cartoon mixed with live action.
With live action.
I didn't even cartoons. Know where to start on that video. That video was phenomenal for some pretty interesting reasons.
It was phenomenal and for the way that it not only there was no narrative sense being made, but it just kept ratcheting up the nonsense factor.
I felt like I got like dosed with acid and like, here, watch this.
Well, the first thing that I know is let's just be direct and say that's maybe the most inefficient car wash I've ever seen.
Certainly.
Nobody was working at the car wash.
No,
because there's fish all coming out of the.
And what was it, like a talking duck or something?
Hip hop talking duck.
I want to know how the fish got in the car with the windows rolled up, though.
So basically, it kind of follows that 80s music video premise where it's like, yeah, there's a loose narrative that if you choose to like sort of follow that like. Whatever, that weird...
I mean, they're cars, and they're, like, people getting into said cars.
Well, we're not going to debate whether the narrative is valid or not. Like, all I'm saying is like, so basically it looks like Billy Ocean has a nice car, and he decides to go through the car wash, and lo and behold, some girl who's clearly not working that day because she's got her pop collar on.
No. She was working.
Yeah, that was the pop collar.
She was working, and then that all came off, and she was wearing like gold.
But that's
the
gold
lame.
It's like,
hammer
yeah.
pants.
Yeah. Yeah, she had the dress on underneath. She was already wearing her evening wear under her work wear. And,
well, most of us do that, I think.
Well, and then the video goes on to show Billy Ocean going through the car wash several more times in several different cars.
That morph into each other as he's going through the car wash.
Yeah.
Look.
Maybe it was a dream.
There's nothing.
Or a car.
We've been talking this whole time about an album that there's nothing that's right with it. Let's just talk about a song where there's nothing that's wrong with it. Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car.
This is a catchy tune.
I can't even think why. I mean, it's just common sense. You okay over there, Ryan?
I am. I'm good.
Okay, good.
Too much pepper on the jerky.
quickly summed it up. Yeah, I'm good. Pepper on, too much pepper on
the jerky.
Hey, let's play a little bit of the song.
Ryan had too much pepper on the jerky. But he's going to be okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
We're just going to try and
breaking news.
Beat that joke.
Let's play a little bit of the song.
All right. This is going to be a little bit of Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car.
I mean, yeah, it's stupid. The song is stupid, but it's funny. But it's in a snickering at him kind of funny, rather than a roll your eyes and want to slit your wrist and vomit constantly kind of funny, like the Meatloaf album. One thing I want to point out is that we were just talking about Def Leppard, the man, the myth that created both Def Leppard and Shania Twain. Was Mutt Lange, who also co-wrote and produced this song.
Is that right?
Didn't see that coming,
nope.
Did you?
Nope.
Neither did I. Mutt Lange co-wrote and produced Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car, which apparently was based on a line from a Ringo Starr song, which shows you what you heard that somewhere else, or you've heard the Ringo Starr song?
No, I read that the inspiration was a Ringo Starr throwaway.
I'm pretty sure that you never heard that Ringo Starr song, because I don't think anybody post-Beatles has been really ponying up the money to listen to Ringo Starr solo songs.
He had a hit or two.
Did he?
Yeah, he had that creepy
Octopus's
thing.
Garden.
It was like, you're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine. That was a solo Ringo Starr hit. Creepy, but a hit.
I don't know that I knew that was Ringo Starr.
Cover song. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he had a hit.
Well, the only other thing I want to see, I'd actually like to talk more about Ringo Starr at another date, but this song was featured in the movie License to Drive, which was famous primarily because it was a vehicle for
the two Corys.
The two Corys, yes.
It was a vehicle for the two Corys.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you hear how I said that? Yeah. We are all on tonight, by the way.
This is a giant metaphor for something.
I just wonder this. Like, and Shane texted me that we were doing this song or whatever, and I just wrote back, I am baffled by Billy Ocean. Like, yeah. I don't know who his demographic is.
We're so related.
I don't understand. Like, I've never heard anybody go, like, you know, that Billy Ocean song's pretty good. Like, nobody even talks about it, and they don't really. He doesn't really inspire
because
like, hatred either. It's just
you
there.
Also weren't listening to Luther Vandross in the middle '80s.
Yeah, but
I've heard people
moon or you know just like talk about Luther Vandross like he was amazing. I've never heard anybody say anything like that about
it
Billy
was,
Ocean.
It was
but he was a major recording artist.
R&B radio staples at the time. It was not our demographic.
This is a slight departure, but on the subject of Luther Vandross, did you know that he was an early David Bowie backup singer?
I did not know that.
So there is some crossover appeal that like those guys are musicians first and they really like get into like sort of a, like and Bowie was looking for a little bit of that sound on a different record. We won't sidebar on that for too long, but
Bowie,
I do think like,
he's a like, star maker. Yeah. Vandross, Stevie Ray Vaughan,
well,
John Lennon played on Fame, landed that one.
I think he was already famous.
John Lennon.
At that point, yeah.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, I think he might. Sorry.
Are you bringing the sarcasm?
Can we go back to? Let's get out of here.
Yeah. So
let's go talk about a pile of shit again.
Yeah.
All right.
Yay!
No, I mean this has actually been a relief. Like this Billy Ocean song is like fucking genius compared to this record.
No, dude, I'm so glad that you said that. I swear to God, I was thinking about when I was listening to this record. I wrote a note. Like I was trying to be, of course, trying to be funny when I picked this song. But I was trying to like goad you guys. But after I was listening to Meatloaf, then I was thinking to myself like, oh my God, when we get to Billy Ocean, it's going to be a breather.
No, it's the ire of the hurricane. It's, you know, it's the...
It's the oasis. Ire of the hurricane?
What's in that hurricane's ire?
Too much pepper,
okay,
apparently.
So we're going to, yeah, so let's bail out of this segment. We'll get back here in just a second on the other side to a little
we're
bit
going
of
through.
And Bat Out of Hell.
On a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses?
Will he offer me his mouth?
Yes.
Will he offer me his teeth?
Yes.
Will he offer me his jaws?
Yes.
Will he offer me his hunger?
Yes.
Again, will he offer me his hunger?
Yes.
And will he starve without me?
Yes.
Then does he love me?
Yes.
Yes.
On a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses?
Yes.
I bet you say that to all the boys.
Clearly, I think if we all had to pick the most cringeworthy moment in this whole album,
which is saying a lot,
we probably just heard it. But a very important point about what we just listened to, this is the spoken word intro to You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth.
Again, a genius song title.
Originally titled Hot Summer Night, which is kind of alluded to in the spoken word intro. But it was this spoken word intro that actually convinced the founder of Cleveland Records, Steve Popovich, to sign this album. So this was, these words were actually what finally got this album made.
No bullshit. What got this album made is Steve Popovich, the owner of the record label, having done a shit ton of cocaine. I'm just speculating. There's no way you listen to that fucking pile, that load of dog shit, and decide you want, I've got to sign them. Got to have them. Well, there was definitely cocaine involved. Where
cocaine,
it's in the mid-70s.
And going like, well, I could probably sell the name Todd Rundgren.
Okay, but that's a small part of it. I mean, we've all seen Scarface or Boogie Night. I mean, you know, like there was
probably copious amounts of cocaine.
It was the mid-70s.
Well, when I hear that, like all I thought was going to happen when I listened to it the first time was like, yeah. Will you offer your throat to the wolf and three-speed on the tree or whatever the fuck the rest of it says? And I just expected the reaction to be like, are you high? Clearly you're high. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard anybody say.
No, it's just sounds like a stage production that you had to, like, you know, get your immediate family to come to, then they politely did.
You're like,
hey dude,
exit.
Hey dude, would you come give me notes?
Yeah, so what'd you think? Oh, it was good. It was good.
I told this on another podcast now, but so I'll make it short. But I think it might have been when Jeff was here, but when our friend James, I have a buddy who curates a film festival and we were college roommates, and we used to go to he would take me to theater parties in college, and I would occasionally bump my shin and go Jesus Christ, and somebody would yell out Superstar and it would become a thing, and I was like, get me the hell out of here. I can't do this. That feels like this crowd on this record. So anyway,
just a little side note, you said we were college roommates, but the way that you broke it up, I thought you said we were called true mates. And it took me that whole time to be like, what exactly did you do in college? Like, what? You made true mates?
He's a good dude.
He had a whole other life.
And there was nothing else that was filtering into my brain other than trying to figure out what that term was. It like an evangelical term? Was it like?
Yes. Yes.
They were like the wolf.
We were called true mates.
They had rings that they wore. And
yes. Yeah,
they hungered.
There was a short ceremony.
I don't know.
Someone offered a throat. I don't know what that was.
Throat of a wolf or something.
Yeah. Anyway, but I think that like that when I listen to that opening montage, I'm like, this can't be for real. Like, there's just no way this could be for real,
dude. When I was listening to this earlier, when I got to this song, the format that I was listening to it, I thought that it might have gotten lost in a shuffle. And I had to go back and
make sure it was still the record.
And I was reading notes and writing notes as I was listening to it. And I had to make sure that it was still on the album. And I was like, this can't be part of this. And I had to go online, look up the lyrics to the song, and make sure that that was actually the beginning of the song.
Yeah.
It's so bad. It's bad, 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 bad.
So I'm just going to break this up and say, like, I do, there's one interesting story that I think is redeeming about Meatloaf. That has nothing to do with, well, it maybe has a little bit to do with the
I've
record,
got one not, redeeming not, thing to say about Meatloaf, and it has nothing to do with music.
Yeah.
That it's delicious?
No, he played.
I hope that they
played Bob with the bitch tits in Fight Club, which you don't love. Shane,
it's a horrible, overrated movie.
I love that. I love that movie, and he's great in it.
God, we don't have a fucking movie podcast.
Yeah. Yes. So anyway, that said, one thing that I thought was interesting was that, like, so, you know, you hear the largesse of how many units this sold and whatever, and we talked about that at the top of the podcast. So what that sort of immediately equates to for those of us looking at those raw numbers are like, well, that guy's just got to print money. Like, they don't live like regular people anymore. Well, the fact of the matter is,
no, he went broke.
He went broke. And he went broke like a few records later. And then he, like, somewhere along the, I guess, several years later, with a different release, started to gain a little bit of traction. And the way that he did it was he went back to playing small rooms, and then the small rooms got a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger. And anyway, he ended up playing big shows again. But I think that was not necessarily the interesting thing. The interesting thing was he was down enough on his luck that his wife learned how to be a travel agent so she could save them money on the road. Like, she learned how to, like, book shit because, like, this guy who had been playing arenas and did all that crazy Rocky Horror type stuff, and it wasn't Hair or like whatever the weird shenanigans were with his career. Like, that's how much the bottom had fallen out of what he did. And I thought that was like a really interesting human interest angle.
Fine. I begrudgingly give you that. That's pretty amazing. Yeah,
screw her for trying to.
No. I said I begrudgingly give you.
Man has a thrifty wife.
That's pretty awesome.
That's a slightly redeeming thing to say.
Can we point out that part of the reason that he hit bottom was because he and Jim Steinem started suing each other back and forth.
And he,
well,
and
I don't
he
know if you guys have brought this up, but like Meatloaf himself didn't write any of this shit.
Well, and he admits, by his own admission, he's a bad songwriter.
He's a bad singer. Yeah. He has no range.
He's a bad actor.
Is he a bad actor?
I liked him in Fight Club.
He was the worst part about Fight Club, and that's a movie I can't stand.
I enjoyed Fight Club.
It's over the top, heavy-handed, and he is the most heavy-handed, over-the-top part of it. So,
good thing we're not here to talk about Fight Club.
Yes, yeah, I know.
It's a good thing we don't have a movie podcast, as somebody once said.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, that was me.
Anyway, but I just did. I thought that that is a non-rock star angle to, like, to somebody actually trying to figure out how to come back from, like, to try and get back to this ridiculous place, which they, like.
Well, fortunately, if you've sold 43 million records, it's easier to get to that place than if
you've.
If you
sold 43 million records, it's going to come back, or the brass ring is going to come back
around.
At some point, you're going
to get back to financial solvency.
Yeah, it's going to happen again. It's going to come back around.
Anyway, a little bit.
Ninth best selling artist of all time?
Something like that.
You're going to make your money back.
You're going to be fine, dude.
Interesting little Texas angle on this, for anybody who's interested in this kind of thing. He's another UNT guy.
University of North Texas?
Yeah, so that's most of Letterman's band. That is Norah Jones. Like, there's a crazy music legacy for that school.
They're known for their music program.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, but... You know, I really tried to look for some things that I thought were positive takeaways from what I knew.
You found one.
His wife became a travel agent to help him book shows.
Yeah, well, I thought that was a little bit of a sweet backstory that kind of is not the thing that anybody talks about.
Well, I mean, I don't wish the guy an unhappy marriage. I just wish he'd stop making music.
Well, then he did Bat Out of Hell 2, which we
Bat
all know
Hell
I would
3,
do anything
Bat
for
out
love.
Of Heller.
Yeah.
Like, and Bat Out of Hell harder.
Electric like Bataloo. Yeah.
I still know what you Bat Out of Hell last summer.
There are two things in reading all of the research that I did that I really was thankful for, and that is Total Eclipse of the Heart and Making Love Out of Nothing at All. Two songs that thankfully Meatloaf did not record.
And was it and maybe, Shane, Ryan, maybe you guys know better than I do. Like, was this a Bernie Taupin, Elton John type relationship? Like, in that sense?
No.
Like, it sounds
I think they worked together on it, but pretty much homeboy, was it Jim Steinem?
Meatloaf says that he worked on the lyrics.
Yeah.
But.
Well, and the writer, he wanted it to be called, like,
Jim Steinem and Meatloaf. Or you know, Jim Steinem presents Meatloaf.
Yeah, either of those.
That actually sounds like the more musical version of this, which is probably what it should have been.
Dude, have you ever heard, like, and of course you have you ever heard, like, Michael Bolton, I mean, you know, famous in the...
If you pick up Michael Bolton record one of these days, I'm going to fucking punch you in the face, by the way.
No.
Things just got real.
I drew the line a long time ago. I might pick a Michael Bolton single, but I wouldn't pick a record.
I can live with that.
But Michael Bolton, I remember, like, reading somebody years and years ago talk about how when white people want to turn on the pathos, they just sing louder. That's what Meatloaf did. There's no range. There's no subtlety. There's no thinking about what he's singing. He's singing as powerfully and schlockily.
He sounds like he's trying to reach the cheap seats, you know, in the back of the room, which is what they tell you in theater class.
But in a cheap way. He is a
theater actor. I mean,
that's it.
But he's a bad theater actor. There's no variation in emotion. There's no variation in... It's just, I'm just, God bless him. I think, you know, whatever. I'm just so happy for him that he sold that many. I mean, I don't begrudge him selling that many millions of records. I really don't. But my goodness, he's a horrible musician.
So let me ask you this. So if this is you, which fortunately for all of us, it's not. But if this is you and this is your legacy, like, what do you do to, like, is there something that you would do to try and change pace or redeem your legacy? Or do you even feel like you need to because there's so many knuckleheads that think this is a great record?
Dude, I think he just has shitty taste.
He has shitty taste.
It's good. Yeah. Like, he probably thinks it's good.
And there are plenty of people that agree with him.
Sure.
He has a powerful voice. He's had a lot of longevity in his career. He's beaten the odds. And anytime somebody like that beats the odds for whatever reason or turns the corner or makes a bet that's contrary to what they think that everybody else thinks and they win that bet in their mind, there is nothing. You're not ever going to be able to tame that ego in any way.
Yeah.
And, Ryan, I mean, you make a comment that, I mean, I can't remember your exact words, but the gist of it just being that, you know, you don't want Meatloaf to make any more music or anything like that. I don't really care if the guy does. I've gone 44 years of my life without listening to Meatloaf until this week. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm glad that I had to listen to this album this week, but
you're fucking pick, asshole. I'm
but I'm glad that I don't have to again. It's my choice. And there are people out there that like this stuff. You know, more power to him.
If I never hear another note from a Meatloaf record, it's been too soon.
I found it fascinating that I had never heard any of the songs of this record. I mean, and you too. I mean, I had.
Can I say one other thing that's been rattling around in my skull, which is that, like, so it gets exchanged in terms of largesse with Fleetwood Mac Rumors because they did things that were similar in terms of
sales.
Like sales and like how
not in
it.
Terms of quality.
No,
in terms
but that's of quality. You and I, like, we all totally agree on that, which is to say that, like, you know, we listen to Rumors and
it's an amazing
record that holds up years later with a lot of staying power. And this secret trick that fooled a lot of people.
But exactly. How? But again, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Ryan was saying earlier, like, he could, and you were saying it too, like, you couldn't figure out if it were a joke or if it were real. There's no way that many people over that period of time, because we're talking about multiple generations at this point.
Yeah.
We're getting into, like, you know, over, we're getting almost into 40 years now with this record. So multiple generations, that many people can't be that fooled that long. Number one. Number two, that many people can't even be fooled for that course of one song.
Well, people have driven to the record store to go find this from a bin, pick it up, take it to the counter, and pay for it, and then put it on whatever their chosen playback device is, and we're happy about it.
No, dude, but
like over and over, like many people have done this.
No, but that having said that, how have I wandered through this life being a musical listener, having heard my copious amounts of classic rock, and never once heard one of the songs on this record in my memory?
Well,
I think that
they're
people
too long
I,
for radio.
No.
Thank God for that.
No. I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about when I was younger. I think part of it is I think a lot of people bought this record because they thought the album cover was really fucking cool, and they shoved it in their album collection and never played it again. I think there was buyer's remorse. It never was played on the radio, by the way, because the songs are too goddamn long.
I did see the video for what's the duet thing with the chick?
Paradise.
I did see that video with the aforementioned sweaty tuxedo. In the early 80s, MTV would play it. And I was pretty baffled.
It wasn't.
By
I would
it
do anything
as like a
for
10-year-old.
And that actually, the video that isn't the woman that sang the song in the video. She's actually lip syncing to Ellen Foley's vocals.
I did not know that. Yeah.
The original Marky Post.
Ellen Foley.
Hey, can we listen to one more little snippet and then.
Snippet.
Yeah,
I think you really just coined a term.
Snippet. No. I really feel
new
strongly
from
about this. And
Keebler.
I feel very strongly about this.
Snippets.
New snippets. I feel so strongly about this record, but I really feel
negatively about it.
Okay, right.
Strongly negative.
Strong, yes. Yeah. But I first prize for shittiest song on this record is All Revved Up and No Place to Go, which, by the way, again, this guy thing. Okay.
Subtle sexual reference?
No, well, there's that subtle. Too. But also, he's trying to, like, what did Todd Rundgren say? Like, he creates, or his manager say, he creates these great titles and then tries to fill up the title, tries to create a song as great as the titles. No, see, country music has punny titles that are actually interesting and intriguing. All you're doing is, like, looking at, like, a calendar on a mechanic's wall that has, like, a goofy, like, caption at the bottom, like, All Revved Up, No Place to Go, yuck, yuck.
Hang in there.
Hang in there. You know, yes, you've got a Garfield calendar, and you're stealing the captions and thinking that those are brilliant. But All Revved Up and No Place to Go, it wins first. The shittiest album that I have heard in a long, long time.
Shittiest song on the shittiest
the
album.
The shittiest song on the shittiest album is All Revved Up and No Place to Go. And we have got to drop a clip of that in there.
All right. So,
and then never, ever,
and
ever
never, and then
to
we'll
it
put
again.
It in the vault and never listen to it again.
Did you want to quote your favorite lyrics from the song?
Oh,
well,
yes.
Well, why don't we get to that on the other side?
That's a great idea.
Right now, we'll play just a clip for from All Revved Up with No Place to Go. Brace yourself.
You and me, round about midnight, someone's got to draw first blood. Ooh, I got to draw first blood.
Yes, describing, quote, describes the beginning of a relationship and also the taking of the girl's virginity. Ooh, I got to draw first blood.
Wow.
Mark, why don't you read some more lyrics from that? Because it's a fucking, there's zinger after zinger.
I'm having trouble with the subtle nuance of this record. Like I feel as if
the subtext.
Yeah. The
why
yeah,
hasn't someone written a companion volume? Like written.
I mean, like there's no Bat Out of Hell for Dummies because it's all for dummies. Anyway, Cliff's notes.
No, I don't have any other words here.
Oh, I thought you had a little bit more.
I've got some from some of the other songs here.
Well, go ahead. They're equally as brilliant.
Well, I just wanted to note that, you know, Shane always likes to poke fun at me because I always bring up my buddy that I give rides to. And sure enough, I made him listen to this record.
Oh, wait.
His
no, wait, wait. We haven't talked about that guy for a while.
Yeah.
So Ryan works in the service industry, and he's got a coworker that doesn't have a car.
Does not have a car.
And every week for a few weeks, he would talk about how he's like, well, I gotta listen to this album, so you're stuck with it, and
well, sometimes it's a good thing.
No, but you know what it reminds me of is he reminds me of the faceless neighbor on Home Improvement, like the guy,
the guy over the fence,
yeah, like that,
yeah.
would just give sage advice.
He's the Snuffleupagus of the podcast,
right? He would just give
Wilson,
sage advice,
yeah.
Mr. Wilson.
Wilson,
yeah. Thing. So this is what this guy does.
Well, I pointed out to Peter, my buddy.
Peter, Mr. Peter.
Yes. That this song sounds to me like just like the intro to an 80s sitcom.
It
like,
totally does. It
know,
totally
like,
does.
Yeah, it's like.
It's that sax solo. It's,
yeah, it's just like Bosom Buddies or whatever. Anyway.
And then like a spinning logo that comes in and tells you like what the name of the show is.
Yeah, yeah. And like Comic Sans font or some shit.
Boing, boing, boing. Like just. Just wacky, like not in it. But later, with a very special message.
A very special episode.
All revved up with no place to go.
And I say this with no hyperbole whatsoever.
My two dads. Sorry, go ahead, Shane.
Sorry. Wasn't the Never mind. No, we'll get into that. We don't have a bad TV show podcast yet, Ryan.
Yet. That's the operative word.
This song, in a litany of horrible, 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 horrible pop songs that I've heard from the 70s, I can't think of one that's worse than this. Literally, this is the give me the heebie-jeebies and nightmares shit kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm stumped, actually.
It's so bad. I mean,
well, the upside is it's over. It's like our national nightmare has ended.
But here's the
fun. Yeah, like Nixon's been pardoned. Yeah. you know, like he's off the stage. We're just trying to recover.
Here's the funny thing about this record to me, and you say it's over, but I hate listening to this album. I didn't skip a second. I hated it so much. It was like an endurance test. It was an endurance test, but it was like also like watching a horrible movie. It's like, you know that I do this sometimes. I force myself to watch Bill O'Reilly as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. I've done that. Yeah. You see how long you can take it?
Yeah, right. That's how I couldn't tear my eyes away, figurative eyes, from Bad Outta Hell.
You know, the only time I've smoked weed in the last, like, 4 years, Shane and I are like this, it just doesn't really agree with us. But I hadn't in years, and so I borrowed a little bit, and I promise I'm bringing this back around to what we're talking about. But I got high. You know, I didn't have anything to do that day, nothing the next day, so I was like, we'll just see what happens. And I ended up watching this really terrible Lindsay Lohan movie that you've never heard of.
Are there good ones?
What's that? No, she was in Mean Girls.
Mean Girls was good.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
That's the one everybody brings up, trots out.
But anyhow, like, I watched the whole thing, and it was just because I was stoned. And I imagine if I'd been high, it would have been easier to take this record. But it's sort of analogous to that, because I watched that whole movie was a fucking piece of shit. And I watched the whole thing from start to finish.
And you knew it was a piece of shit the whole time you were watching.
I was like, well, I'm invested at this point. We'll just see what anything redeeming comes of it.
I can't imagine that even pot would have made me enjoy this album or even endure this album even better than I did.
Well, Mark, thank you.
Yeah.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you for the pox-covered blankets.
We're warmer, but we're dying.
Don't be surprised if Shane is out sick again next week.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about next week. So that for those of you who...
Kevin may have a life event.
Yeah, my wife is very close to...
dropping her new release.
Having another kid, so... I don't know. We're just going week to week on these, and so I'm not really necessarily sure that I'll be here for next week. But if I am, the record choice is mine. I don't have it yet, but I'll come up with that in the next day or so. And so next week will be a surprise. It will not be whatever I choose. It will not.
It's not Bad Outta Hell 2.
We're not going to have to suffer like we suffered this week. So that's coming. Shane, welcome back. I'm glad you're alive.
Glad to be alive.
Glad, yeah, you're a lot
glad
less
the show.
Phlegmy than I expected.
What's that?
You're a lot less phlegmy than I expected.
Yeah, well.
Phlegmy, wasn't he a character on All Revved Up with Nicolas Ago in the 80s?
He's one of the Stooges.
He was the drifter.
He was the wacky next door neighbor, I think.
That's
actually.
Right. Well, I would really like to thank all you guys for having me come in. And
It's like you're like a little boy sometimes when you play with
He's got his new toy.
Like the grin on your face.
It's a shitty gag. Mark, thanks for joining us. And so
Mark's
going
to be joining us a lot, though. When Kevin goes in hibernation for a few weeks. Right, Mark?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope to step in and fill whatever parts of Kevin's shoes that I can.
Sure. Yeah, so Mark will be saying... things about
he'll be saying who's coming out.
Yes, exactly.
Right now
we didn't do that this show actually. So
right now Mark is playing the voice of the reasonable person, but hopefully Ryan
give it a couple
and I,
of weeks.
Ryan I will so infuriate him within 2 or 3
weeks.
We'll
break him.
Yeah, we'll break him.
No, Mark right now is the get off my lawn guy, but given a couple of weeks, certainly like there's no way to gently go through this record. So I think this is a good start. Excited to do next week's and either I will be with us next week, or Mark, you're certainly welcome to keep joining us for as long as you like, and then or Mark will be in my place. And this is Somebody Likes It. I'm Kevin Newsom.
I'm Ryan Newsom.
I'm Shane Bartow.
And I'm Mark Cuvion.
We'll see you guys next week.